Hello. This week, I'm deviating from the regular schedule to give you something a little different. I thought today I would share with you some patrons-only content. What you will hear today, as our regular listeners, is what was available for our patrons last week, in addition to the regular podcast. I hope you enjoy this interview with Rex Hutchins. Hello, welcome to this patron special, the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. I am Ben Williams, your host. Today, I'm pleased to bring you an off-the-cuff interview with none other than most illustrious brother, Rex Hutchins, the author of Bridge to Light. Most watchful brother Rex is a past grand everything. Out of Arizona, he's been the Grand Master. I think he's been the Grand High Priest. I think he's been the most illustrious Grand Master. And I think he's been the right eminent Grand Commander as well. He's also been the, if not the SGIG, then certainly the deputy appointed by the Supreme Council to run the Scottish Rite. He's a 33rd degree Grand Cross. Perhaps the most decorated Mason I know. He's a prolific author, very eloquent, remarkably intelligent, and a great conversationalist. I want to say it took me a while to get this interview. I literally had to call him up and have my recording equipment ready to go so that I could get him on the spot, and he consented, which is fantastic. I hope to spring another interview on Rex sometime in the future. I do have questions prepared. Didn't have them handy when I called him this time. I wasn't exactly sure if he was going to assent or not. And I want to say that no interview can substitute personal conversation with Rex. If you ever get the opportunity, go to Tucson, Arizona, visit his temple that he's been putting together over... Rex Hutchins, thank you for joining me on the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. I'm super excited to interview you on the air. I've been chasing you for a while, so thank you, sir, for agreeing on this beautiful spring day to be an interviewee. There's millions of questions I could ask, and I just figured I would start with, your background, if you're open to that. I know you've got a PhD. You're not an undereducated individual. Is that right?
Well, yes, that's true. I can't deny it.
And it's in anthropology, correct? You're a doctor of anthropology.
Yeah, educational anthropology is the discipline.
Mm-hmm. And what does that entail? What does that mean? I know you have a lot of Sanskrit, correct, in your background, which is fascinating.
Yeah, but that's hardly related to the PhD. My dissertation was on Cuban women.
Right.
One of the areas of interest in anthropology is what we call directed culture change, where instead of culture changing over a natural evolution in a closed environment, there is an intent by some agency of some sort, such as the government, in the case of Cuba, to institute specific changes in the cultural milieu in order to, in the mind of the person doing it, improve things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't.
Fascinating. I think many governments probably employ similar strategies to some extent consistently, one might argue.
Yes, I think that's true. It's a question of degree in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
What I was looking at was the change in the status of women 25 years after the Cuban Revolution.
Interesting. And you actually had diplomatic permission, diplomatic passport to...
No. I just went there and maintained a low profile and talked to people. I did have some great cooperation with people like the Federation of Cuban Women and some other individual agencies to.
That must have been a fun time. Was this in the 19...
particular women for interviews and such.
Amazing. And this was in the 1970s? 60s?
Late 70s and early 80s.
Late 80s.
Yeah.
So that must have been a fun time to be in Cuba.
Yeah, it was between about 78 and 84.
Wow. Well, I bet you got some great memories. And I hope you smoked a lot of good cigars.
Well, yes, that was included in the experiment.
Did you happen to attend Lodge there? I've heard that Masonry was never suppressed by Fidel Castro because he sought succor or shelter in a Masonic lodge during the invasion back in the day. Is that correct?
I don't know that that's true, but he certainly did not particularly bother Freemasons. They had built a building which was prominent enough to make it a Cuban postage stamp. And that building was built in order to be able to house the Grand Lodge of Cuba and some individual lodges out there. And there was a lot of available rental space which supported the Grand Lodge activities. And after the revolution, landlords were frowned upon and the building was taken by the government, and they allowed the Grand Lodge to keep its floor and the auditorium and a library, and the rest of it was turned over to various government offices.
That's pretty cool. So the government and the Grand Lodge shared a common space, at least for a while.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic. It's on Salvador Allende Boulevard, which is named after the freely elected Chilean Marxist president that the CIA arranged to get rid of and replace with Pinochet.
Wow. Okay. Did you have any designs to go back to Cuba? I think our trade relations.
I've said that occasionally. It's become a lot more open and it's more tourist focused than it used to be.
Right.
A lot of the ideals of communism as they understood it at the time of the revolution have largely fallen by the wayside.
Interesting.
Doesn't look much different than any other Latin American country now.
Except for their medical facilities, I guess. I don't know if that's exaggerated
or not.
Well,
they're very good. The polyclinics they build are just excellent, and they're everywhere.
Right, right. I heard they've got a pretty high literacy rate, that sort of, you know, individual wealth rate may be relatively low.
Yeah, there's argument about it. The proponents of Cuba as a model of Latin American socialism put it at about 98%.
That's pretty good. It's probably better than America. It's better than the U.S.
Well, of course, it's considerably better. This is not talked about much in America. The year of the alphabet, it was called, they went from about 25% to about 98% literacy in 9 months.
Wow, that's impressive. Okay, so they basically instituted a nationwide literacy plan, got everybody reading.
Yeah, it was extremely extensive. They shut down colleges and high schools and junior high schools and let these literate children go into the countryside and teach adults how to read and write.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it was an amazing program.
Yeah, it makes
Most
sense.
Most Americans are not even aware of it.
No. I mean, I think there's been quite a bit of propaganda probably, you know, ongoing for decades, right? I think old Castro turned to the USSR simply because he had no other choice. I realize he had some sort of, you know, communist revolutionary ideology, which was necessary for him to do what he did. But we may have created a friend when we had an opportunity and decided instead to create an enemy, perhaps, because we didn't necessarily trust a populist leader, maybe. I don't know. I don't know all the nuances of the political situation, but I am given to understand that Nixon, was it, absolutely despised Castro. Is that correct?
Well, I'm sure that's true, but the issues that cemented the problem were way before that. They were goes all the way back to 1958. I mean, this was a conflict of values so fundamental that I don't think that a long-term friendship between a communist Cuba and a capitalist America was very likely. scenario.
But pre-revolution, Havana was kind of a playground for the rich, right? For the of the northeastern United States, it was kind of
well,
like
it was totally corrupt.
Yeah,
you know, casinos were operated by, you know, organized crime, and it was just a very corrupt system.
It was Atlantic City abroad.
The major businesses were American controlled, and the situation of enforced poverty through low wages. It was just reprehensible.
Wow. Okay. Well, can we pivot to, you know, your Masonic dealings, Rex? I mean, you're a 33rd degree Grand Cross, you know, you're, according to the folks that are not members of the fraternity, you know, you are the Illuminati. If it exists, you've got all of the decorations and at the height of Herodom. You're the author.
Well, if you deny it, they call you a liar. So it's better to affirm it. And if you're going to be called a liar, might as well lie and say you are.
Well, when I say that you're not, they say, well, you just don't know, you know, because I'm too lowly.
That's where the problem comes. They just assume if you say you're not, then you're lying.
Right. Or if someone like me says you're not, or like, you know, I've never met anybody in the Illuminati, they're like, well, you're just not high enough up yet. And I'm like, well, but you're not even a member. So how do you know better than I do? At least I'm a member. You know, I mean, come on. But you're the author of Bridge to Light, which is the companion text to the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite as conferred in the Southern jurisdiction, which was a pretty amazing I don't know if it's an exegesis, if that would be the right word, of each of the degrees.
It's an attempt to explain in basic language, you know, without getting too sophisticated in terms of esoteric matters, what the basic teachings of the individual degrees are. It's kind of a little help guide for the candidates is really what it is. And that's why it's given to the candidates at the completion of their 32nd degree.
So you do believe that Freemasonry has an esoteric component?
Well, yes. I mean, people who don't are just not paying attention.
Yeah, well, I would agree, of course.
The easiest way to see it is in its alchemical and Rosicrucian kinds of relationships and involvements, and even the aspects of Christianity that have been involved in Freemasonry are esoteric aspects, and therefore it's pretty hard to deny. Kind of like what Arthur Edward Waite said about the Rosicrucian influence on the 18th degree, that lies upon the surface for all to see. And that's pretty much the same with the esoteric nature of Freemasonry. It's just there. You have to go out of your way to miss it.
Right. Or to deny it. I have a story about a KCCH back on the Western Slope who once told me, Ben, no one cares about that Kabbalah crap. That's just for the ritual. Why don't you write something else? I was writing something for the newsletter, and I was kind of amazed because having just gone through the 29 degrees comprising the Scottish Rite, I mean, Kabbalah was mentioned quite frequently, and certain depictions seem to symbolically suggest, you know, Kabbalah had a strong influence, and of course, Morals and Dogma and Pike and everything too. So, I mean, you would argue that Jewish mysticism comprises an important inspiration in the degrees.
It's unavoidable. It's there. I mean, it's just you read it and there it is.
Right.
The Ken Sefiro are regularly cited in the lectures of Morals and Dogma and in the ritual itself. And this is an unavoidable thing. Mm-hmm. It's just there.
So a recommendation.
The same way it is in the Blue Lodge. I mean, wisdom, strength, and beauty are the three pillars of the Tree of Life. And that's that. And nobody can argue that. They can argue and say it's a coincidence, I suppose, if they're really inclined to that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
unlikely.
The evidence is pretty straightforward.
Yes. So you would, to a new member, you would recommend studies in Platonic theology, perhaps? Or what would be a good book that you might suggest for our listeners to pick up and read if they're unfamiliar with some of this material?
Well, I don't know that I would recommend anything right at the beginning. I think people who are new in Freemasonry need to be paying attention to the experience of the degrees themselves and not be too concerned about learning things. That's not the purpose, for example, of ritual. It's not to teach anything. It's to promote a particular kind of experience. It has a transformative intent, and that transformative intent is, I think, impeded by over-attention to detail. Mm-hmm. And certainly they don't need, in the middle of getting these degrees, for, especially first three, to be distracted by reading books written by all kinds of people with all kinds of opinions about the matter, some of whom don't have a clue what they're talking about. So, and they don't possess the knowledge at the time to have a critical attitude about what they're reading, and therefore they're either misled or confused, and therefore gain little by the experience. And they're better off, I think, in most cases, to just stick with what's going on around them and have that experience and enjoy it and not get too preoccupied with external matters.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, you said it's a transformative experience. The ritual itself has a transformative effect on the candidate. Then is that what you're saying? And the best way to sort of experience that is to just be open.
Well, if it doesn't, it's not ritual.
Right.
The purpose of ritual is to transform. And this, maybe we see that best in distinguishing between ritual and ceremony. And the example I always use is a marriage. If you have a wedding, the wedding event for the bridegroom is a ritual. For the audience watching it, it's a ceremony. Mm. And the difference between the two is the presumptive transformative phenomenon of the marriage act itself, which is for the bride and groom's ritual.
It's a really good analogy.
If it's not, and if it's ceremony for them, the probability of the marriage being a success diminishes considerably, and probably accounts for why 50% at least of all marriages fail, is because it's not a ritual experience for them. It's merely a ceremony, and therefore they do not undergo that transformative phenomena that is intended, and the marriage has less of a chance of success as a result of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, so you're defining ritual as something that does take one thing and turn it into another. In the case of a marriage,
yes,
taking,
and if it doesn't, it's not.
Yeah, right. Then it's just a perfunctory ceremony.
That makes sense. A huge number of our candidates, there is no ritual in Freemasonry. It's a ceremony for them, too. And that's why they get to 3 degrees and disappear. Mm-hmm. They were only there because their grandfather was a Mason and somebody told them they ought to be. And it has no meaning for them.
Or that maybe they were looking for something that they didn't find, unfortunately.
But sometimes happens. That can be the incompetence of the people performing the ritual.
Yes, no, I agree. I mean, if you are open to what is being said and discussed, there are definite remnants of interest. But I agree. I mean, some folks I brought in way back when, you know, we were using a chamber of reflection there before the first degree in Norwood Lodge back in, I'm going to say 2009, 2008, sometime around there anyway. And three of the guys just didn't come back because they thought it was hokey after the first degree. And each one of them said the chamber of reflection was the only good part. So, I mean, and it, you know, that's not to knock the ritual performed by the Brethren of Norwood Lodge, because they actually did a really good job. These guys just didn't really, I think, understand what was being said, or maybe they weren't listening. I don't know. Because there's definitely a lot in there. I mean, just even the giving up of the shoes and the Book of Ruth, I think, is quite significant in and of itself. And then you think of the movements about the lodge kind of like turning keys in a hidden lock, perhaps, to open up apertures in our psyche, maybe, to receive impressions. I don't know, but I do like your analogy there of ritual versus ceremony, and I think that's a really good takeaway.
I think it's important to distinguish. In most of the texts I've read, they are almost treated synonymously, which is very unfortunate, because I think the distinction matters. But
it's
interesting you mentioned the shoe issue. You know, that comes from a King James translation of a passage in the Book of Ruth, which is utterly misunderstood, because it, in the text itself, it's a reference to the Levirate law, and they have to get them. Ruth and Boaz have to get the gentleman who has a legal right to her in marriage to give that up. And so Boaz can marry her. And the way in which he acknowledges that is by removing the shoe. And the problem is in the King James Bible translation says to confirm all things. And it wasn't to confirm all things. It was to confirm one particular thing. And this is a problem with some of the ritual in Freemasonry in that the King James translation is probably the worst in common use. And therefore, it's full of all kinds of things that encourage confusion and misunderstanding. And that's the one we picked to use in our ritual.
Well, it was the one most widely available, I'm sure, back in the 18th century or what have you. I mean, but could it not be allegorically interpreted, sort of like, you know, the Song of Solomon? I mean, is his love for the bride or the maid in the Song of Solomon just flesh and blood? Or is there potentially more that could be read into it?
Well, of course, it's an allegory. There's no any doubt about that. But what kind of an allegory it is and what kind of a message it's trying to reveal is perhaps open to interpretation. But in a lot of cases, with the King James Bible just had bad Greek antecedents, and there were very few of them, and it came out in a literary way, beautiful English, but not necessarily accurate to the original text.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there's puns and stuff.
That isn't. And it was bowdlerized and, you know.
Right. Right.
The reference to the large tail of the hippopotamus. And I've seen a lot of hippopotamuses, and I've never seen one with a large tail.
Right. Well, and your eye of the needle as well, right? Camel is rope. Is that right? I think you told this to me before once.
But, Kamala, yes. Well, see, rope was made from camel's fur hair, and therefore the words are very similar.
Right. So, the
confusion comes from Hebrew being a triliteral root system where you have these three consonants that have a general meaning, and then the specific meanings within it are controlled by the use and placement of particular vowels. And so, since vowels weren't written in Hebrew, it was an invitation to confusion.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a pretty broad language in that respect, isn't it? So, you know, the particular verse is a rich man, it's easier for a rich man to get into heaven than a camel to go through the eye of a needle is how it's typically translated.
Yeah, rope is much more appropriate.
It fits the metaphor better, for sure.
And it fits with the nature of the way Jesus made his exaggerated examples of things. It's much more sensible. And in fact, it is rope in the Syriac Peshitta text.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So that's interesting. Yeah, you get all these elaborate explanations of the metaphor that, you know, the needle was the sort of name for the place where you had to enter when you were going.
They make these up because they're trying to account for what is nothing but a bad translation.
Well, it's because it's the infallible word of God, Rex, right?
Yeah, but even the people who believe in that infallibility acknowledge it's infallible in the original.
Right.
They don't claim the infallibility for the translation.
I'm not so sure about that, but yes, I think that would be wise because certainly there's been translation, transliteration, redaction. I mean, you know, when you talk about the Bible, I think we need to talk about which Bible, right? Because, I mean, they're not all the same. Yes.
Yeah.
But there are people out there who would deny that.
Yeah. Most people don't know that, for example, the pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock had utter disdain for the King James Bible, and their Bible was the Geneva Bible of 1595.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't even know that. That's great to know. So that would have been,
and
what, written in German?
What they brought to the world to use was the Geneva Bible, which is still in print in English.
Oh, it's in English.
It was frowned upon by King James because he was trying to not get in too much trouble with his Catholic relatives. And there are a lot of anti-Catholic notes in the Geneva Bible. And when King James talked to his translators for his Bible, he said, if you use notes, use them sparingly and don't be knocking the Pope like they do in the Geneva Bible. And so you don't find these anti-Catholic notes in the original King James the way you do in the Geneva Bible.
That's very interesting. Didn't the king have like the copyright for all Bibles printed? Like, didn't you have to pay the crown or something if you were to print a Bible? Or am I off base there?
The knowledge of that one way or the other.
Okay. Well, I'll look into that.
It was not significant in that time. I mean, people printed what were called King James Bibles, but they were really authorized, you know. But the question was authorized by whom? Mm-hmm. And the answer really was nobody. I mean, it just, that was the translation that was made available. And it was dedicated to King James because he had ordered that a new Bible in the English language be made to get rid of the difficulties of primarily of the Geneva Bible. Because there were a lot of English Bibles out, you know, there was the Bishop's Bible and the Coverdale Bible and all these different Bibles floating around. But you find the word tyrant, I don't know, 400 times in the Geneva Bible, and you don't find it once in the King James Bible.
Hmm. So, yeah, politics creeping in.
Yeah, so there were issues that he was concerned about that control, that translation. And then Freemasonry ends up picking that one as the one to use for its ritual, which was really unfortunate.
Well, James was instrumental to, wasn't he, for the Shaw statutes and everything? Wasn't he kind of the monarch that was associated early on with sort of speculative, the emergence of speculative masonry? Or am I just way too early on that?
Well, there's a lot of talk about it. I haven't seen the evidence, but there's a lot of conversation about it, and a lot of our literature refers to it.
Yeah, the Shaw statutes were 1598.
Yeah, right? I'm not in a position to verify one way or the other.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was said he was he's supposed to have been a sort of mystical king, right? He was interested in the...
I would certainly say it could be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's nothing about it that would be intrinsically ridiculous or anything.
Yeah, I wonder if
his... And the time's not that far off. 1611 is not far off, actually. Seems like it is, because it's a century before the founding of the Grand Lodge, but... Mm-hmm. It's only half a century before other references.
Yeah, so, I mean, Robert Murray was, what, 16-something, 16, I'm going to say. I mean, there's Lord Alchenick, I think, was 1640s anyway, going in, and he was obviously not a, you know, a stone worker. He was certainly a speculative mason, if you will. He was of the gentry anyway up there. And then Robert Murray was, I think, mid-17th century as well, and the Shaw statues.
Yeah, he's the first Scotsman, I think.
Yeah.
Record.
But yeah. And then we've
obviously got, there were others before him. We don't have records of. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's Auchinleck and his brother were both in there. I think Robert Murray was the first guy made in England, perhaps, because he was like around Nottingham, somewhere in the north anyway. And then you've got Ashmole and everybody else. But it is interesting that there was that connection between the Maester of Works. I want to say Robert Shaw, but it's not Robert Shaw. He's the actor from Jaws. I can't remember his name. Shaw, the guy who wrote the Shaw statutes. You know who I mean, right? But that was
50. Yeah, they call him Shaw statutes. And that's all I ever.
I can't believe I can't remember his first name. It's that guy from, you know, from Jaws.
That Art will know. Anything you don't know about that, ask Art. He'll know.
Yeah, well, I'm going to look it up right now online here since I'm sitting in front of my computer. It was William Shaw. There you go.
Sounds right.
Yes. So he actually mentions the art of memory in the Shaw statutes. So as early as
that was a big thing in those times.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Bacon was a great advocate of it. Everybody was.
Yeah, this is 2 years before Giordano Bruno meets the flames at the stake. So yeah, there were supposed to be quite a few masters of the art of memory. So I think, you know, it's creeping into the speculative craft at its earliest origins, which is kind of neat.
Well, you know, we're still one of the few systems of education that require extensive rote memorization as part of the learning process.
Which is really good, right? I mean, it's sort of like a mental gymnastics. It certainly...
Well, I think it is. You know, that it still requires a lot of discipline, and some people are less willing than others to participate in that. And a lot of Grand Lodges have allowed it to fall by the wayside for the higher value they have of acquiring members.
Yeah.
I won't say Masons necessarily.
No, I think you're right there. I mean, I don't want to, you know, the risk of sounding elitist. I think that the memorization work is important for actually the reasons you just alluded to. Number one, it doesn't just sort of separate folks by their ability to deliver the proficiency. So in Lodge, you can get a sense of the man, right, by the way that he has interpreted and is able to recall the ritual. But it more importantly requires that discipline to set aside the time necessary to learn it, right? And that I think...
Well, I believe there's a connection between the rote memorization of the words themselves and the principles they teach.
I would agree with you.
If you learn the words by memory that way, where you can recall them extemporaneously in virtually any situation, I think you have absorbed that not only those words, but what they teach at a different level than otherwise.
Yeah, well, words have a power, right? So you're acquiring all of the concepts and inculcating them.
That's why I support the notion of having it. When I was first in Masonry to become Master of Our Lodge, we required all three lectures from memory.
That's brilliant.
Every Master of the Lodge knew all three.
Suddenly
one day, somebody wanted to be Master of the Lodge and didn't want to learn all three lectures. And so the next thing you know, Grand Lodge is saying, well, you really only need to learn one. And then for a while, you didn't need to know any. You only had to make sure somebody was there who knew it.
Right, which is the current way. I mean, that changes who's capable of being master, right? And in order to be master, I mean, if you learn all of that work, then you sort of know how to respond when certain situations present themselves anyway, right? I mean, it's just in the reciting of the officer's duties even, right?
That's the intent, yes.
Yeah. Well, we need to go back to that. You know, how do we do that? I don't know. Is it too late to put the genie back in the bottle? I don't know.
Well, I think it's probably cyclical, you know. It's part of, you know, ego's science. It'll degenerate, and people will realize that it degenerated and fix it, and it'll cycle back to what it's supposed to be eventually.
So, yeah, there's great opportunity.
It's only choices.
I'm sorry, Rick, say that again. I cut you off. I didn't mean to. I apologize.
Either it'll cycle back to those higher standards of expectation or it'll disappear.
Right, right. And so in this current contraction of membership, there is great opportunity, correct? I mean, and we're seeing some pretty crazy growth, Rex, here in Denver, in the Metropolitan Lodges. South Denver, one of my home lodges, had over 30 candidates standing on the second, in the midst of COVID even. And they had double digits for the third. And excuse me, they had over 30 waiting initiation, double digits for the second, and I think they had double digits on the third as well. So really,
one has to wonder who's been assigned to teach them anything.
Well, we got to keep them. Exactly. We just got to make sure we keep them. So actually, we're doing a fellow craft degree in a few weeks. And I'm actually fortunate to get to do the stair lecture, one of my favorite lectures in all of masonry. So I've actually got it sitting right here on the desk. I've got to sort of relook it over. I haven't done it for so long, but I'm really looking forward to it. I love that lecture so much. But I don't know all three of them. I'll tell you what, Rex, I wish I did, you know, I probably should just start doing that to try to, you know, you should really know the whole blue book really, you know, now that we have it printed, we don't have any excuse. I mean, in the days before it was printed, you'd have to learn it all at the feet of another master, right?
I heard that. That was before my time.
Okay. Well, you had the code.
That's how it was done.
Yeah, which is brilliant because you really have to, I mean, that's a transmission right there. And you have to make the dedication to spend it to sort of take the mantle from the previous guy. And I don't know, it's difficult. And I understand why we don't do that anymore, but it's a shame. It's a shame that we're either not able to.
Yeah, I don't see a lot of value in that outside of the psychological connection of the brotherhood phenomenon itself.
Yeah, well, that's huge.
Which is available in other venues, and so I see the writing of the lectures, I think, is a perfectly appropriate thing to do as a way to transmit them.
Well, it maintains correctness for sure, because otherwise little variations creep in, right? Well, let me ask you this too. This is going to be a strange question, but it's one I like to ask, and I can't wait to ask it of you, Rex. Is there magic in masonry?
Well, that's one of those words that's a little bit dangerous. it tends to conjure up illusions of illusions, and you know, to think of superstitious things that you might call, you know, that kind of magic that people believed in, where you could mix up elixirs to make somebody fall in love with you, or
transmute metals,
or, you know, all that kind of stuff. The magic is really, you know, you might as well stick with Arthur C. Clarke's perception of it, where it's indistinguishable from modern technology.
From science, yeah. Yeah, and that fits with the Royal Society. But, you know, you did mention our alchemical past. So, you know, some of that certainly is obviously spiritual and mental, but in the Renaissance, there was definitely practical alchemy, correct? Where folks were really trying to transmute metals.
Yeah, that was there. And that's a kind of an argumentative topic where some people believe it was legitimately pursued in the way the alchemists themselves explained it. And in general, though, it's, you know, speculative alchemy became psychology and operative alchemy became chemistry. And that's just kind of a path we can delineate pretty clearly, especially through the writings of Jung.
Yes.
On his book on alchemical studies, for example.
Beautiful. So you think that basically...
pretty interesting stuff. I think Masons should read it. It's hard to get some Masons to read that sort of thing. But yeah, I think it, from a historical point of view, it's good. A lot of our symbolism comes from alchemy.
Yeah. And the symbolism
is kind of a thief of all systems when it came to symbolism. We pretty much stole from everybody. Alchemy, Christianity, stonemasons, Kabbalah, it didn't matter if there was a symbol, we'd take it and make something of it.
Right. Yeah.
Which is good because it became, therefore, a repository of symbols and ideas that might otherwise not have survived history.
That's it. No, I like that. That's very, very true. So I like the repository angle a lot, actually, because it's like a place for remembering. You know,
we keep them. They're, even though they're there and we may give them some interpretation, there are plenty of other places that will talk about the same symbols in a different context and give a different meanings.
Gives a whole new meaning to the art of memory. excellent. Well, Rex, this has been great. I really appreciate you making time to do this, and just to do it sort of spontaneously like this has been really fun. So I can't wait to see you again. I think things are going down out there finally. So things may return to normal this year, knock on wood. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Me too. Have you had your shots or anything yet?
Oh, yeah. Both of them.
Oh, good for you. My wife's had hers. I haven't had mine yet. I guess I'm not expecting to get them until, I don't know, sometime in summer probably, I guess. But by then, hopefully it'll all be over. So,
well, we could hope so.
Yeah, hopefully there's no weird mutations that creep on in or anything. So there was one other thing I wanted to ask you, but it's actually escaping my mind right now. So I hope I can reserve the right to call you again at random, Rex, and do this to you again.
Sure,
I'll spring it on you. All right. Well, God bless you. Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for being a patron of the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. Your support is much appreciated. And until next time, Take care, and Godspeed.